This is Conversations with Canadian Art Song Project. We're your hosts, Lawrence Williford
and Stephen Philcox.
I'm Lawrence Williford, and this is Conversations with Canadian Art Song Project. Although we are recording a podcast that will be listened to across the continent, we acknowledge that our conversation is taking place on traditional territories of the Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, and Wendat nations. Today, I am honored to talk with mezzo-soprano Marion Newman and composer-pianist Ian Cusson, both of whom have been important artists giving voice to Indigenous and Métis peoples in song and opera. Welcome to you both.
We have this really
difficult conversation across all of North America regarding Indigenous peoples and their cultures and appropriation. Before we get too far into this conversation, I just want to give a perspective of where I am in this context. I am a settler, and my ancestors on both sides of my family have been in North America since the mid-1700s. My mother's family were religious immigrants from Switzerland, and they immigrated to Pennsylvania. And my father's family came to Virginia from England. I was born in Michigan. I came to Toronto as a graduate student in 2003 and became a Canadian citizen 11 years ago. Marion, I've known you as a performer and a colleague way before I had any idea that you were of Indigenous background.
Right. Living in a big city, it's easy to not know what someone's background is, even if they have a tan. And that is something I actually love about the city, is that I can be sort of anonymous here. Out west, growing up on Vancouver Island, people often said, "Are you native? Are you Indigenous?" Because I fit within that context and I look Indigenous from the West Coast because I am. Mm-hmm. I'm Quagilth and Stalo on my father's side. I grew up with the Quagilth ceremonies, potlatch ceremonies. Mm. Right from birth, I was given traditional names. Through my life. I have four of them now. And at the same time, at the age of five, I started taking classical piano lessons in the Suzuki method. Mm-hmm. And so I've grown up with all of my styles of music. My mom is English, Irish, Scottish, born in Canada. So I'm also half settler. Mm-hmm. And it was a really rich upbringing. And we were always very open around home about who we are, what we are, not hiding it. And I'm old enough that I was growing up in a time when people suggested that because I can pass for non-Indigenous, people might, well, there was a while when people all assumed I was part Asian of some sort, or Spanish. So it was suggested by very well-meaning people that I allow that white passing to happen because my career would probably benefit from people not knowing that I was Indigenous because of the beliefs that people have about Indigenous people. And I just refused.
Yeah.
I think right from being a kid, I knew that it was time to change that narrative. I knew I was intelligent. I knew I was just as capable as anyone else and that the Indigenous side of my brain was not less than. Mm. So I think that was a really strong and amazing way to grow up. I've always loved being who I am. And I've also really enjoyed the fact that I have the settler's perspective as well. It forces me to consider what it's like from both sides. Mm-hmm. And at least both sides. There's probably more sides than just two. and so navigating being Indigenous, navigating being non-Indigenous, having these conversations about the truth of Indigenous history, which Canadians have not been taught until very recently. I come at it from an angle that understands that it's not easy.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult topic to grapple with. And
so you were raised in an atmosphere where arts and culture and music were a massive part of your upbringing, from what I understand. Mm-hmm. Your parents are artists. Your brother is an artist. Can you share a little bit more of that context?
I'm the eldest of three. I have the middle kid, my brother, is Carrie Newman, and he is a very well-known Indigenous artist. And he uses all mediums, from totem poles to modern types of, I guess, graphic arts and anything in between. He's got works all over the world. Our father has been a carver since he was young. He's part of a family where my great-great-grandfather was a carver. My great-grandfather was a carver.
Amazing.
It's just been passed down through generations. Yeah. And quite famous carvers, actually. Even in a time when it was illegal to practice our culture in any way, which included singing songs, they were allowed to carve because it was considered art, not necessarily culture. So that has been a way that we were able to continue some of our culture, at least throughout. And my mom is a fabric artist. So for years, she has been sewing designs that were created by my dad and my brother onto clothing. Much of what I wear on stage comes from my family. They dress me. And it is unique.
Kidding.
And they're designs from my family and where I'm from.
That's amazing.
They speak to my background. And I have a sister, Ellen, who is a social worker, and she works for the government now, helping to create policy.
In BC?
In BC, yeah. And to create Indigenous engagement on boards and such. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty amazing family, and it's no accident that I ended up being an artist, because that was so much a part of our language.
Where did you do your musical studies when you were looking at grad school and moving into a professional career?
I went to UVic for piano. And I also went to Camosun College for piano. And I had to take voice as a second instrument for some of that. And it was supposed to be just a year of voice. But I absolutely loved it. Mostly initially because of the collaborative nature. Mm. Piano, you spent hours by yourself in a practice room. And when you are on stage, it's all up to you. Mm-hmm. And I am actually really shy, and I guess I was quite nervous often to perform in public. And what has driven me is just that music is such an important language, and it is such an important way of expressing deeper feelings than I've ever been able to put into words. Right from the age of 5, I knew that people could understand that I was feeling more than I could express. Mm. And so that hooked me. Mm-hmm. But when I started to sing, I realized I always have at least one other person on stage with me. You can work with a whole team of people when you're doing an opera or an oratorio, and it just takes the pressure off of just you. And it's such a joy. I love people. I've met like so many important people because of music, important people to me in my life. It's just so enriched by that teamwork.
Yeah.
Anyway, I went to San Francisco Conservatory after I received my bachelor's in piano, and I did a master's there in voice.
And then the big wide world of professional singing
opened
up.
And then I started stumbling around in this career, yes.
Brilliant, brilliant. Ian, you're an emerging composer. Your voice is now being heard in a wide variety of ways. You're also a church musician and a pianist. Can you give a little bit about your background and how you came to become the musician you are?
I'm from a small community in Ontario called Penetanguishene, Midland, and Ontario. It's a kind of trifecta French pocket in Ontario. I grew up there. My family's lived there for well over 150 years. I am French-Canadian and Métis, and a mix of other European kind of nations in there as well. So my family was, like many Métis people, was part of the fur trade back in the 19th century, worked for the Northwest Company, did work on all the water routes, trading furs and all of this good stuff. Some work in the Red River. And my family intermixed with Europeans and First Nations folk, and kind of created or became part of these kinship connected communities that that neither identified themselves as European and also not as First Nation, but rather as this other half breed thing that had its own particular cultures and intermarrying and all that good stuff. And so that community has remained robust in this small little pocket in Ontario. And some of the exciting things have been sort of the culture, the music that I heard around me as a young person. My own journey into music was taking lessons as a kid, piano lessons and voice lessons as a young guy. And composing. Oh, I've composed my whole life, written music. I take a bit of a different journey than most professional working musicians these days, or especially most composers in Toronto and in Canada. I went to the Glenn Gould School to study piano performance, and I stayed there for a year after high school. And then I left and went to the University of Toronto to study English literature. It was such a great complement to the kind of musical world that and musical training that I had. And that's the extent of my study in undergrad in English literature.
Right.
Compositionally, I've worked with some important Canadian composers like Samuel Dolan. Back in the 1990s, when I was, I guess, an energetic teenager, I would go to his house for private lessons, and we would sit for, you know, 4 hours at a table, and he would study my scores, and he would say nothing and then make a circle something and make a comment. So I have some kind of fun connections there. Did some work in San Francisco with Jake Heggie, mm-hmm. And have worked with a few other folks here and there. But a lot of the work that I do has been, I guess, self-taught for the most part.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It seems to me that quite a lot of your work is primarily with voice, whether that's chamber ensemble, piano. I know you're doing other things. Is that, again, as a result of kind of your early childhood and being in an environment where song is really, really important to you?
Certainly. And I think being surrounded by teachers who brought song into my life, mm-hmm. and in particular opera, and sort of awakened a passion for art song and opera at a young age. So I guess I caught the bug and loved the form and loved what was possible. I think the thing that draws me to art song and to opera is the capacity to tell a kind of tangible story, a story with words, mm-hmm. And sounds. And so that certainly also is another connection point to my own cultural roots, is storytelling and watching a kind of character grow and change over the course of a series of songs or over a longer period in an opera.
Yeah. One of the reasons why Stephen and I were so excited about bringing you guys on board for a conversation about issues dealing with Indigenous peoples and Métis peoples' stories and song is there's been, in the past few years, there's been a kind of re-examining what has happened and how do we move forward and what is okay and what's not okay and what has been appropriated and what has been done in collaboration. Both of you have been working quite a lot in that sphere in the past couple of years. Marion, you've had big song cycles that have been commissioned for you. And opera, you've been involved with Brian Current's Missing, Dean Bury's Shano Divit just recently, and a number of other projects. Can you just talk a little bit about what this past few years has been like for you in creating different characters, representing various Indigenous cultures?
Yeah. Coming from a classical background, right from when I was young, I really thought it would be cool if I could combine my worlds in some way musically. And I did a bit of composing when I was young. And so
I've heard one of those songs, which
right,
I was
my
really
lullaby
wonderful.
That yeah. just keeps on going. and there wasn't really anything that addressed my Indigenous side within the classical repertoire that I was learning, either on the piano or on the operatic front or the song front. The last 3 years approximately have really been like a dream coming true, in that Indigenous storytelling is merging with classical music, and I'm able to use my classically trained self to tell stories which a lot of people need to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been very exciting. It's been really meaningful. Like, it's added an element to performing that is so not about myself. It's more social conscience side to things that makes it really, really meaningful for me. And I've worked with teams and casts of people who are not necessarily Indigenous. So I watch that learning start and see what different people's approaches are to, and what different people's acceptance of those stories are when they start to learn the truth. So I just feel so fortunate that I'm able to get up in front of a symphony orchestra and sing Ian's songs, telling truth and watching that audience take it in. Speaking with the players in the orchestra who come up to me afterward and say, oh my gosh, I had no idea about this thing. And just watching those conversations start and having some of them. And then meeting people like a year or two later, having them approach me again to say, I've done a lot of learning. I'm listening to the news differently. I'm paying more attention. And wow, there's so much we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a unique career at this point. I mean, there's a long history of Indigenous people being singers, classically trained musicians. But it's really just now that they are doing so in a non-appropriative manner, not having to wear a costume, for instance. Another role I played this year was Chinina Redfeather, and it's a play with song. And these songs were collected by a non-Indigenous composer who went around North America collecting Indigenous songs and then putting English words to them.
Oh, wow.
So, like, completely changing the meaning and putting them on a concert stage so they're not within ceremony. Just turning them into, like, art song is what they thought they were doing, parlor songs.
Right.
And that was a really interesting role to play because from Chinina's perspective, it gave her an opportunity to sing songs that it was actually illegal for her to perform in any other way.
And that was the narrative of that story, was dealing with that.
Yeah, grappling with the now, because there is a guy who is studying music somewhere at a university in a big city, maybe Toronto, who comes across these songs. And to him, they're shocking because they are so clearly appropriation.
Yeah,
and so he and Chinina meet in sort of a dream world halfway between and discuss.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Well, we're going to touch more on that very topic. That's a massive part of Indigenous music in
for
this,
sure.
The settler understanding of Indigenous music for this country. So we'll get back to that. Ian, I'm really curious. You've just recently, it's just recently been announced that the National Arts Centre Orchestra and the Canadian Opera Company have commissioned you for a new piece to be inserted into Harry Summers' Louis Riel and then to be able to return a song that was appropriated and included in an opera in a context that was completely inappropriate. That's massive. I mean, that's an extraordinary opportunity, I would think. Can you talk a little bit about this experience for you? And then also talk a little bit about a number of your song cycles are setting Indigenous poetry and how you're considering those texts now.
So the Louis Riel aria is, it's been a hot topic in, you know, in the classical music world over the last couple of years. When the NAC and COC for the sesquicentennial year decided to remount this 50-year-old opera, it came to the attention of both organizations quite late in their preparation. It was a couple of weeks before, or maybe a couple of months before the first performance. Some scholars, in particular Dylan Robinson, had done some research, and that included making these organizations aware of the fact that one of the pieces of music in the opera was a song taken from a people on the West Coast, the Nisga people, and it was used inappropriately. It essentially is a ceremonial song that has a particular set of law. Of Nisga law around who can perform those songs or who can sing those songs, when and under what context or situation they can actually do that. And to contravene or to go against that is to violate Nisga law. So this was brought to the attention, and then this led to really quite a fascinating set of discussions that have been ongoing for over 2 years now with both Nisga people and these two organizations, the National Arts Centre and the Canadian Opera Company, and the estate of Harry Summers and Maver Moore, about what ought be done with this opera, which has this embedded piece of music. And the decision was made that the song be removed from the opera and a replacement piece be be inserted. It's quite interesting because Summers wrote the piece for the Montreal International Competition ahead of writing the opera. And so the piece itself pre-existed the opera. And mm-hmm. when they Moore and Summers came to writing this scene, Harry Summers said, hey, I've got this piece, this work that exists. It would work beautifully for this scene. And so there was a text that existed in the libretto for the scene, a lullaby. And they just kind of forgot about it and brought this older piece into the work. So removing it from the work, from my perspective, is something that it makes sense because it was kind of an insertion. But what it means for me, you know, being involved in a sort of, I'll call it a hairy process of working on another person's work and coming in some capacity to it, I realize is a tricky thing, and it brings up a lot of musical questions and a lot of, you know, some for some people ethical questions, as well as whether a composer's work should ever be changed or adjusted. Mm-hmm. And it has put me in an awkward position with people who very much disagree with that decision. Some who disagreed quite vocally about that decision, and some funny things have been said to me directly about my involvement. But for me, what appealed and what was compelling was the fact that this wrong or this poor decision that was made in the 1960s to include and use this music that was protected and was sacred, to use it and to kind of remove it and return it to a people. As far as I understand, that has not been done. It's been done in other contexts and within museums with some artworks, but it hasn't been done in song. Mm. And so being a part of that has been quite special. It's interesting that I'm able to then set an original text. So there's in some ways a reconnection with the original creators of the opera. And I'm able to look at it from my own vantage point of my own cultural perspective in 2019 as a Métis person living not in that part of the country, but considering the words that I guess you could say an ancestor, you know, by relation of mine would have sung to a child, which in some ways is like a song being sung to me is how I read it. So it's quite a special, amazing, you know, process to be a part of. I guess in terms of my other practice, you mentioned my songs. You know, I've written a number of song cycles, and not all of the works that I write have an explicit kind of indigenous content or message.
Yeah.
The most clear indigenous song cycle that I wrote was one on poems of Marilyn Dumont, who is a Cree Métis poet living in Alberta. And these were texts that I actually came across in my undergrad in English literature, reading a Canadian literature class. This visceral set of texts about the half-breed experience.
Yeah.
And I remember in 99 reading these, they had just been published, and they gave a kind of voice to my own experience and also a different version of my experience, one that I didn't experience as a woman living in that particular part of the country. But one that gave rise to a certain series of feelings. And so then being able to set them to music and put them in front of audiences that wouldn't normally hear them was a really special thing. And so I have looked for opportunities to set Indigenous texts in terms of song cycle and song. And also tell Indigenous story that's not heard often in these contexts and this format.
Yeah. It's interesting, you both alluded to the ethnography that happened beginning of the 20th century in North America, and how the settlers and the Canadian government and arts organizations viewed the use of those collected songs that were likely taken or collected under completely different understanding of how they're going to be used and then integrated into all of this music, which is similar to what was going on across the globe, whether that's Bartok or Grieg or, you know, Smetana, right? Like this was going on in the beginning of the 20th century and a very nationalist, an attempt to make nationalist kind of Western music. And even in the States, I grew up in the States. I don't have a recollection of indigenous music playing a big impact in terms of the national sound, but certainly slave song, work song, mm-hmm. Appalachian folk song, the gospel sound, you know, that is the American sound. So when I came to Canada for studies and started looking into the repertoire and was trying to understand the Canadian culture and what's going on artistically here. And there have been times when I've been wondering, okay, so what's the repertoire that engages with Indigenous song and Indigenous music and the Indigenous culture, assuming that was a positive thing. Fortunately, I didn't pursue that because with the understanding that I have come to now, it is completely inappropriate. I recently just read My Conversations with Canadians by Lee Miracle, and she has a chapter that discusses appropriation. And I just want to quote her a little bit here. Jurisdiction over land was seen as much for the domain of caretaking responsibilities as our sustenance. While our art, carvings, blankets, stories, and songs were seen as private or family property, and hence personal wealth, which was intended for giveaway, no wealth existed simply for its acquisition. Private property is the foundation of citizenship and civilization in European society, and intellectual property is an extension of private property. While the power of our names, our stories, and our songs is what our inheritance is about. So reading that completely changes my understanding of Indigenous art. You've both alluded to this, and that is the basis of a lot of music in Canada. The preeminent composers of Canada were encouraged to use these songs. And what do we do with this now?
It's really important to note that those songs were collected by ethnographers at a time when it was literally illegal for people to sing those songs. Mm. So the people they were collecting these songs from thought that would be the only way to keep those songs alive, mm-hmm. and to pass on to future generations. There was something called the potlatch ban, which banned all Indigenous ceremony right across Canada. Potlatches are from out west.
Yeah,
I'm from a potlatching people. But there are powwows. Just like everything was illegal. Feasts. Anything that had to do with staying connected to culture, acknowledging people for life. Events all wiped out. And so people agreed to sing these songs into a wax cylinder because they thought that they would never have an opportunity to share those songs orally, which is passed down from generation to generation for so long. So it was under some duress. And so that legal issue is a really, really big one, because I don't think that anyone would have recorded them like that, mm-hmm. had they thought that they would be able to pass them down properly, mm-hmm. and in the way they always had.
Well, the children were taken away. Like, who do you communicate these songs to?
Right. It was violence done to people. And also, the people that they were collecting these songs from all across Canada, there was a belief, an understanding that we were not going to survive. Mm-hmm. Reservations were created without proper infrastructure because they thought they wouldn't last very long and they'd just be taking over that land at some point anyway. So don't put in proper plumbing, etc.
Yeah.
So there was an expectation that we were going to die off, all of us. And so having those songs, like, no one would have been here to say, hey, that's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There was no understanding that they're not simply folk songs, which was the precedent set in Europe.
Absolutely.
These were sacred, and songs are beings. They are alive and must be sung in order to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's pretty weighty, large topic.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, I think, of the whole question of what is public domain. You know, this is a Canadian law or concept and an international one, but you know, the idea that something is collected by an ethnographer, even for us in 2019, looking back and thinking about the way we approach materials that exist in places, you know, something was collected, those people are long dead, it's past a certain period of time, therefore they're up for the grabs. And I'm using that expression intentionally. I think this idea of there's lots of material to be mined and to be kind of extracted and taken. We still to this day, I think, encounter and have to come up against that thinking of materials that exist by peoples. And, you know, there is still a temptation to say, well, I mean, I want to tell that story. I want to share that melody. I want to use it. And often intention is great. And I think in the case of many of the historic Canadian composers who did this, there was often not a negative or poor intention. But it was also under that very, shall we say, colonial structure of, yeah, of materials to be used.
Mined, in a way.
Mined.
Yeah.
Yeah. People to be mined, often without acknowledging the context that those came from, consulting those people, asking permission, giving credit, even compensation to. So if you think about works that exist, and if even, you know, royalties are paid for these works to be performed, you know, are any of those royalties passed to the people from right. whom these songs were taken?
Right.
Collected
right.
is the genteel word.
So I'm curious to work with you guys, to listen to some things,
yeah,
and to show you an example of how to consider what might be inappropriate or what might be appropriate. Mm-hmm. So the first example is kind of the most egregious, unfortunately. There's some songs that Ernest McMillan arranged that are taken from a period of ethnography. So he went out to the West Coast and with Marius Barbeau and collected and transcribed songs. Eventually, he published these transcriptions in, I think, Music Canada, which was a journal. And so we have an example of one of the songs that is in a collection called Three Indian Songs of the West Coast. And there's both the indigenous text and there's also an English text by Duncan Campbell Scott, who was Deputy Superintendent of the Department of Indian Affairs and was a strong advocate for assimilation of the indigenous peoples. So this is seriously problematic. So we're going to play a part of it. It's sung by John Vickers. The pianist is Richard Wojtacz. So this is a spirit song. We'll just listen to a very brief part of this. Sir Ernest McMillan, wonderful musician, important Canadian musician, did a lot of incredible things for musical education, certainly here in Toronto, celebrated conductor of the Toronto Symphony, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Good intentions, I'm sure, from his part. But I don't know. What's your impressions there?
Oh boy, so much to say. Well, first of all, this is the song that Harry Summers used in Louis Riel that was removed. Uh-huh. It was based on the same melodic kind of idea, mm-hmm, from sung by Scatine, or the Song of Scatine. I mean, just a comment on the presentation of the song in terms of even the accompaniment. Mm. There is a clear kind of Indianizing, yeah, of the sound, this the open fifths, this, yeah, kind of dun dun, the ostinato pattern, yeah, And to me, you know, to this day is one of those challenges is kind of the exoticization, and I would even say the fetishization of Indian. It's when a person not from that culture would take that and kind of present it back as something from that culture. Yeah. To me, I mean, this started playing and we were chuckling. I it's hard to suppress the laugh. It sounds hilarious, yes, in one sense.
Well, yeah, the piano coming in immediately with that drum beat. As a young pianist, I would sight read music from children's music books. And my mom would try and not let me play.
Yeah.
Like my little canoe song,
yeah,
or what have you. And I was, of course, fascinated by these because, sure, they were not allowed.
You got very good at perfect fifths. So, yeah.
Yes, totally. Yes. But yeah, that's what's happening in this piece right, yeah, off the bat.
Yeah.
And it just reminds me of all those little songs that were forbidden.
Yeah. No, this is it. Frankly, this is pretty disgraceful. And I would suggest should probably never be performed in any context ever again. Any one of these songs. So there's an example of the worst case scenario, and apologies if that did offend anyone. But hopefully that's the last time you'll ever hear that. this is an example of what not to do, not what to do. So I'll be honest with you, there's that kind of fetishization of the drum beats appears in a lot in various contexts in these songs, which, you know, it's remarkable to think that's in one little, two little, three little, mm-hmm, Indians on your, this is how you play perfect fifths. The fact that that goes as far as some of these most accomplished composers is pretty, I mean, it's unbelievable, actually, to think it's there.
I do understand that they meant no ill.
No, absolutely.
And that they were very much encouraged to use these songs.
Yes.
And to fetishize, because that is part of erasing, mm-hmm, what was.
Yeah.
And another thing that it brings up is that a lot of these songs still sit in museums, and they are not back in their communities.
Yeah.
Which is what people were told would happen.
Yeah.
So I, like very recently, about a month ago, met someone who works for the ROM, the Royal, mm-hmm, Ontario Museum. And when she heard that I was Stalo, as well as Cogilth, she said, oh, we have these songs sitting in the museum and we don't know what to do with them. Maybe you could help bring them back to the community. Mm. So museums are starting to realize that there's,
good,
something that needs to be happening with,
good,
that.
Right.
But that's really recent.
Yes.
Jeremy Dutcher,
yes,
collected,
absolutely,
his songs and brought them back to his community in his way. And it's revitalizing culture.
Yeah.
But there is a lot of pushback to do that for a very long time.
Yeah.
And there's still concern over whether or not the conditions for holding a wax cone cylinder are right, so that it isn't ruined, etc., etc.
Well, let's continue. So here is a work by Harry Summers. So this is the same composer of Louis Riel, and that is not a negative thing. That it just shows that he was trying to engage with this material, because frankly, that was, again, it was encouraged. A lot of these works were commissioned by Eckhart Grammaté, CBC, you know, the institutions that were doing the commissioning. So the one that we have here is Shaman Song. So this one is being performed by John Hess and Valdine Anderson. The text on this is collected by an ethnographer, Knut Rasmussen. He's part indigenous as well, and he traveled the Nordic countries and collected a lot. So this was collected from an Inuit woman. So let's hear a bit of Shaman Song. I know this is one of these that was performed quite a lot, and I believe this was commissioned, Ian, you've got the score there, it was Eckert Grammatein, I believe?
Yes.
Yes, right.
For the national competition, yeah.
So, extended piano techniques, mm-hmm. more extended vocal techniques as well, mm-hmm. but dealing with very similar issues is the other example.
Yes. And this is, they actually do say who they collected the words from, an Inuit woman.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, commendable.
Well, I believe it's actually with permission from the estate of the person who collected,
right.
But that's not...
That's still... And again, we've got the drum beat happening, that there's a pan-Indigenous thing happening here. Mm-hmm. Like Inuit music and way of singing is very different.
Oh,
from
yeah.
the rest of Canada. In fact, our musical styles were very different from coast to coast and north to south, and that is not being acknowledged.
Right.
There's no understanding of the fact that we're all different.
Right.
I think that just as a point in general, that sort of idea of Indigenous person, this is so funny. It's as people will often say, oh, you're Indigenous, as though that's one singular thing. Mm-hmm. The reality is, I mean, my own experience in this one part of the country versus Marion's experience in a complete, like almost a world away, probably was night and day. Maybe the closest thing we'd have together is some of our musical education, but it's two worlds. It's language difference. It's culture difference. I mean, we had no potlatch. I have no experience of that.
Yeah.
And so I think, but often it's convenient to be lumped together. What's interesting is sometimes we will lump ourselves together. And I think there is value at times to say, as a collective, as a group of people coming from different nations, we're at certain points speaking with one voice. And there, that can be done to great effect and is important.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the reality is there is great diversity across the land.
Well, that's more like saying the United Nations has a joint statement
of
on
course.
X rather than...
Right. Then we are one thing and have one set of beliefs. What's it, my one observation of Summers, in some ways, I think his writing is really cool.
Yeah.
There's some really neat stuff that happens in the work, in his work in general. And I've been spending some time with it, obviously, quite a bit recently. But he does use this this interesting grace note figure. Da-dum, da-dum. Mm-hmm. And he uses it a lot in the indigenized parts of his sound in the opera Louis Riel in particular.
Yeah.
So when an indigenous character is singing, it often has a ha ha ha, and you have a lot of that here.
Right.
It seems to be a gesture that he's going to suggest indigenous. You know, even in my own practice, if I'm writing something in an indigenous text or story, the question is, do I participate in a kind of a false indigenization of the sound? And I've made that a personal, and again, this is my own personal decision. It might be different from another indigenous composer, but to not do that, to sort of avoid the exoticization, even the self-exoticization of that sound world.
I've got another example, actually, that's based on the same text by a friend of Harry Summers, good friend, Harry Friedman. And this is also the husband composer of Mary Morrison. Again, we're dealing with the prime musicians of the period. So here is an excerpt of Great Sea from Harry Friedman's cycle Anerka, originally composed for soprano Lois Marshall and piano accompaniment. This recording features a chamber ensemble including Robin Engelman, Andrew Barashko, Erica Goodman, Trevor Tureski, and soprano Wendy Nielsen.
This one's very different from the
completely,
last two.
Yeah.
More atmospheric sounding, yeah. And it seems to be something that I have encouraged composers to do when setting any indigenous type of story, is to use their own voice, their own musical voice to do that, their own emotional voice, yeah. And to understand that we are people too, and we have emotions just like everyone else. Yeah. And so that is valid, just to give us that
yeah.
scope, a larger musical language to represent us, I guess. And so I do feel like this is not that same kind of
romanticization.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
It was a work that was commissioned for the centennial year. It seemed to be a hot year for thinking about indigenous.
Well, a lot subject. Of money was put into creating lots of work of art. You listen to John Beckwith, and when he was talking about the difference between the centenary versus the sesquicentennial, the amount of music that was being commissioned and composed was enormous right. at the centenary. But obviously, a lot of that focused on trying to utilize what was being kind of a romantic Canadian voice.
Right. So. And it's interesting, yeah. I mean, having participated in projects in the sesquicentennial year, it was nice to see that Indigenous people were actually invited to be those voices mm-hmm. that actually wrote that music. I mean, all of the examples that we've seen so far, none of them have been an actual Indigenous voice in the room. One interesting note in the score that I'm looking at is that the poems are from a collection translated, and there's the name of the translator, used with permission of the translator's estate.
So this is the same individual in the last piece.
So it's quite interesting to know that, you know, permissions, of course, for a translation are critical, and that's mm-hmm. something that I would consider if I was using a translation. It doesn't necessarily reference who the original, in this case it says Eskimo right. poem and poet was. We would use a different term for that now. But Lance, I think an interesting question, though, and this is about, I think, wisdom. And what I get asked a lot is, so am I allowed to perform it? And it's funny to be asked that question as though I'm a kind of gatekeeper of permission, which I am certainly not.
Right.
I can speak for particular things from my own community, but even then, if I was participating in telling stories from my own community, I would have my own process of consultation and conversation about that. So, is it singable? Should it be performed? I mean, I really think it so much comes down to a question of wisdom. You know, understanding what is the context under which it was created, and is this a helpful song to program these days? Should it be mm-hmm. programmed in the context of historical information being provided as well? And these are questions I think that the individual has to answer. It's hard to make a declarative statement from my perspective.
Sure. Just wrestling with a lot of these things myself, I find it complicated because these are pieces, or the songs were collected in a completely different context. Permission's given from the translator and the estate, but is permission given from the singer and the holder of the song? And I mean, personally, that's the bigger question.
Right.
And does that mean that we need to return to these communities and say, how shall we deal with these?
Yeah, I do think that they need to be returning these songs to the communities where they belong, and asking their permissions or their opinions, what do they feel? Because that might be different for different nations.
Yeah.
There are those, like that sacred piece being used in Louis Riel, that's a pretty obvious one, that it doesn't belong there. But there may actually be songs that have been used that were, like, we have fun songs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That might be appropriate to be used, but with consultation
right.
with the community. And that is something that was never encouraged. It wasn't like, go to the community, meet people, find out
right.
how they feel about this.
Right.
Because it didn't matter.
Yeah,
we weren't important enough to consult.
Yeah,
and that's hugely problematic.
Yeah.
I wouldn't perform any of these pieces, even if they came from my community.
Yeah.
And that is something I'm learning as I go. There was a time when I didn't know any better either. I believed that if it was published in a book, it was
okay.
up for grabs. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm still learning. I'm sure I have a lot more to learn. I think this whole topic is evolving, and I don't know where we're going to end up. But it has to involve the communities from which the songs came.
Going back to the West Coast, there's two composers that I want to look at there as well. Gene Coulthard's songs are considered prime real estate for a lot of Canadian singers and recitalists. And she's got a collection of, she calls them Haida songs. This one is called Love Song and is performed by Carol Davis and pianist Harold Brown. So again, this is another text that's collected by a very well-known ethnographer, and I know this collection was used by a lot of composers. So, thoughts there?
Again, the person collecting the songs is acknowledged, but not the actual family that this song belongs to. We never perform or sing our songs without acknowledging who that song came from, what family it belongs to, and that we've been given permission to sing it this time.
Yeah. This gets back to Lee Miracle's kind of statement, is that this is inheritance and this is gifted.
And we must always acknowledge where that came from. And that we, and like, I have sung some potlatch songs here in Toronto at different events, but I never do so without calling home. And checking with the family that those songs come from and saying, would it be okay in this context? And to make sure that I've got the names right of who I'm acknowledging for this, et cetera, et cetera. And that is it's a really important part of performing anything.
Yeah.
That is completely, it's more erasure, not knowing where that really comes from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's funny listening to that. I don't know that work, she's such a great composer, I have to say.
Yeah,
and
I know.
What beautiful sounds.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that's a really important point to acknowledge, is that some of these works are really strong. I mean, some of them may not stand the test of time, and by virtue of maybe being a substandard work, might disappear. Here's a great example of something that's quite singable and that people would want to program. I say that because I think it's an important additional point. Does that then give a person license just because it's a great song? I think these are the real questions, and what Marion says, I couldn't agree more with.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to make sure that we had an example that felt comfortable in a way. Mm-hmm. And Gene Coulthard always feels comfortable.
It's really beautiful. It's gorgeous.
So I'd like to go to another BC composer. This is Sylvia Ricard. Canadian Art Song Project programmed her songs. The collection of the work at the time that I programmed it was called Four Indian Songs. And I asked her if we could change the title. She has decided that she wants to go with the title for First Nations songs. And so she is working actively to make sure that all the scores held in the CMC libraries and whatnot are changed. So I hope that that project is going well. And that's the title that these songs should now exist under, for First Nation songs. So there are three songs in here that are collected texts, I believe, by the ethnographer Francis Densmore. So there's three in that collection, and that falls in a similar category as many of the other songs we've talked about today. But the last song is actually by Shirley Daniels, and it's a newly written poem by her. She's good friends with Shirley's daughter, Chantel. So she has permission for this, and it goes back to the source. And this poem is actually about Shirley's father. I personally think that this is a prime example of a great Indigenous text being set. But I'm curious about what your ideas are on that. This is a live performance by Victoria Marshall and pianist Mélisande Sansoulier. And this took place in 2015 at the Richard Bradshaw Amphitheater here in Toronto. This is Drums of My Father. So, thoughts on that?
Obviously done in consultation with the person who wrote the words, and with permission. That is totally fine with me. Yeah. That's how to do it.
And a comment on the sound. It, you know, the song is called, it references drums in the title, and you get a really sweet kind of suggestion of drum sound in the accompaniment, and where before that felt out of place and it felt kind of superimposed, here it feels completely connected to the text and the intention of the song. And so to me, that's a successful marrying of text and sort of context or setting.
I had a very similar response to that, and that's why I wanted to highlight this one as well, is because drums is in the title of this. Drums is part of the soundscape that she's trying to invoke, but it didn't seem...
It's integrated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well done, Sylvia.
Well done.
Yes.
and that was done, I believe that piece was composed in the 80s, so still an appropriate work even now. The last one that I think I want to think about in terms of soundscape and whatnot, the name of the piece is called The River Child. The text is James Reaney, and so James is a celebrated playwright, author, poet, was a collaborator with John Beckwith on a number of projects in terms of opera. The composer Chester Duncan is based in Winnipeg, or was based in Winnipeg, in Manitoba. He was actually a professor of literature, and he's kind of revered as a local composer that a lot of Manitobans love and like to perform. So Canadian Art Song Project is actually working with the Canadian Music Centre in putting together a collection of his songs. And we came across this as it was given as an example of one of the pieces that is done and requested quite a lot. Again, this is text by James Reaney. It deals with Indigenous subject matter, but it is not Indigenous text. So let's have a listen to a little bit of this.
Mrs. Brightfeet walked along, picking berries by the river. I will take your seventh child, was the river's turning song. Turn away, you cannot turn my child away from me. She hurried back unto her home and noted one was missing. We saw him last down there by the river to turn my child away from me.
That was a performance by the tenor Orville Deraux, and the composer Chester Duncan is the pianist in this recording. I value this composer's voice, but I do find this one problematic. It kind of gets back to those drum beat sounds and fifths going on in the piano. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's mimicking that simplicity of sound, I guess, that is very Hollywood.
Yeah. There's a great book, The Imaginary Indian, which is written a number of years ago, that goes through a number of these sort of representations of the indigenous person. You know, the peaceful warrior, the one, you know, sitting in the canoe in the landscape, who has really no agency or no activity, yeah. Or the savage warrior. I mean, all of the different kind of tropes.
And this one's the lamenting mother with their child has been
right.
Washed away in a river.
None of which are really human. They're sort of a picture of what someone wants this person to be. And again, thinking about that and hearing the musical context, I would say it seems to reinforce that to me. But again, these are our opinions. And so this is an individual choice that has to be made by the programmer, I suppose.
And yet, I think it's important for us to have a conversation that can start prompting other people to have conversations around this repertoire.
Yes.
The last example I brought along with me is a set that is extremely well known. These are the Three Métis Folk Songs by Malcolm Forsyth. They were written for Maureen Forrester. I think of all the works that I've kind of given as examples, these are staples of the repertoire, or have been for such a long time. Although this work is often performed by voice and piano, our excerpt features the orchestrated version by the composer. This recording is with mezzo-soprano Maureen Forrester and the McGill Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Richard Honitch. This is Chanson de la Grenouillère from Three Métis Folk Songs from Saskatchewan by Malcolm Forsyth.
Voulez-vous écouter chanter une chanson de vérité? Le 19 de juin, la bande des bois brûlés sont arrivés comme des braderies. En arrivant à la grenouillère, nous avons pris trois prisonniers. fra prisonniers des arcanis qui sont d'ici pour pire de notre pays. De nos gens se sont mis à crier, de nos gens mis à crier, voilà l'anglais qui vient nous attaquer. La 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 qui se croit empereur, il veut agir avec rigueur. Le gouverneur qui se croit empereur à son malheur agit trop de rigueur. Le gouverneur qui se croit empereur à son malheur agit trop de rigueur. La 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 la.
Full disclosure, I've programmed these before in a recital 3 years ago, mm-hmm. And played them. They're actually quite difficult to play. And I quite like the orchestration.
Yeah.
It's really well done. You know, I programmed them because I was looking. I like many of us went to the Canadian Music Center and said, What is there of my culture here? What exists? And I did the search, Métis, and this one pops up.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe a couple. And so it's interesting that I was drawn to them initially through the title, which maybe is problematic as well.
Well, but that's how so many people begin the search. And,
yeah.
and for this, they may not have that
yes.
relationship culturally, but that's they're doing it out of
yeah.
a desire to participate.
And from my perspective, I didn't know these tunes from childhood, and I spent zero time researching them as well. And this may be the difference between Ian, myself, in 2019 versus yeah. Ian in 2016. And this is the kind of ongoing learning that Marion was referencing earlier is, you know, I would spend more time before programming them again to say, you know, how informed
mm-hmm.
were we in putting these together and just mm-hmm. not walk as quickly into them. I also think they're great songs.
Yeah.
So,
well, one of the things that I find interesting about this set specifically is, again, they're collected. This is a group, I believe, of seven Métis folk songs that Barbara Cass Beggs collected and then published. In this set, the first two are also folk songs that you can hear in Belgium yeah. and France. And all of these notes about the provenance on these are at the front of the the front of the score, so we have information about that.
Yes.
Again, the way that I'm thinking about these, the first two I would have less questions about. The third is the one that comes from a Métis source, and it's got the most information about, so that's good. But I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. And great crowd pleasers too. They play well in a recital.
Also, the interesting thing about a lot of folk songs in terms of how we present them on the recital stage or even the concert stage, they're often put at the end. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that you kind of do to loosen everybody up and go, oh, that was so fun and that was nice and it's positive and everybody might have some sort of connection to these songs. They seem familiar, less heightened. That's whether they're French, English, Welsh, Irish, you name it. I mean, this collection of folk song repertoire is often done in that way. But for these songs to be lumped in among that kind of category, also I find very problematic.
I think we each need to navigate this kind of territory in our own ways.
Mm.
And my feeling now is, why would I perform those when I have Ian, who is Métis,
yeah.
who is an amazing composer, whose music I love? I mean, I just wouldn't bother with
yeah.
something that might be problematic.
Yeah.
because I don't need to. And who knows where we'll end up somewhere years down the road. But right now, it is my instinct to actually go to Indigenous composers or librettists, writers, to have actual Indigenous content involved in the creation, and people who are alive, who I can speak to about their process and what they had in mind while they were creating these pieces, what was their intent, etc. And I tend to want to perform things that actually tell truths and don't forward these ideals, the, the romanticized versions of what people think. And I even very recently have performed music I really wish I hadn't. You know, you sign a contract and then there's a whole cast involved and you don't want to ruin it for everybody. So I have gone ahead with them, but I'm learning from each of those that it takes a huge chunk out of my soul to do something that is uncomfortable. It's so painful. And so I'm learning that I have to say no to those and allow other people an opportunity to make their own personal decisions. But yeah, I'm just compiling a list of things I won't do again. And I apologize very sincerely for missteps that I have taken, and I promise to learn from those and to help create change that is positive and that brings true Indigenous voice forward in the way that is comfortable for them.
Foolishly, really occurred to me right now that the problem with a lot of this music is it's quote-unquote Indigenous music, but a lot of these composers have nothing to do with being Indigenous.
There was a statement in the manifesto that came out of that group of Indigenous classical musicians, some composers, some performers, had in Banff a few months back, which was, "Nothing about us without us," was the statement. So if you're going to tell our story, consult us. And that's maybe what is lacking in some of the works that we looked at today.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for wading in these waters with me. I'm coming at this with eyes wide open, realizing I am ignorant about a lot of things and trying to educate myself and trying to be aware as much as possible in approaching repertoire and in discussion with other people. And as artistic director of a company that is trying to advocate art song and art music in Canada, this is a big pool of repertoire that, you know, I just kind of looked at and thought, I don't know if people really have thought through this repertoire right now, and having your voices and thoughts and just the process that you would come to any of this, I think is so valuable for me and valuable to a host of other musicians, teachers, and performers. We would like to thank the following for giving Canadian Art Song Project permission to use the recordings for this episode: the Canadian Music Centre and Centre Discs, the Canadian Opera Company's free concert series in the Richard Bradshaw Amphitheatre, Laurie Duncan and the estate of Chester Duncan, Carol Davis, and the Schulisch School of Music at McGill University. And thank you to Dennis Patterson, our recording engineer, for this episode. If you like this podcast, please subscribe, like, share, and write a review so we can be heard by more listeners in the future. Thank you.